Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, July 10th, 2003. Today's session is Putting the Fun Back in Dysfunctional, Session 4 of God in the Highest Heavens, God Wrestling in the Mud, presented by Jonathan Preuss, number PRJ 2003-04. Let's listen in.
If you have to ask, you won't get it.
Oh, you bailed her out too soon, John.
Let's start with prayer. Gracious God, we thank you for another beautiful, beautiful day and for this gathering of brothers and sisters from many different places, for all the experiences and wisdom and thought that they represent. Lord, we thank you for this chance to think about your word, to delve into it, to find something to give us another view on the way you work in the world, the way the world really is. And we pray your blessing, particularly on our study today, as we read these stories about King David and his family, that through all of the ups and downs of David's life and the riches of his faith and at the same time the depths of his sin, that you're there through the whole thing, working out your own purposes. Lord, we pray you work out your purposes in our lives with all their possibilities and with all the sinfulness that still clings to us. And bless our time together in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, we've got stories of David today. We'll leave the patriarchs, but we're going to see a fair bit of similarity between the family of David and the family of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and the boys. If we continued with the stories of Jacob's family, we would have got to a very kind of tawdry episode with the Shechemites and Dinah. Remember the one girl? Well, they're sojourning in a place called Shechem, and the prince of Shechem, the son of the king, just is hungry after Dinah, daughter of Jacob and Leah. And finally he forces her and really rapes her. But unlike the guy we're going to read about today, he loves her. He wants to marry her. And the brothers of Leah, I mean of Dinah, sons of Leah, pretend that it's okay. And they say the only thing is that we can't really be in relationship with you. The flocks and herds of the Jacobites are also at issue. The Shechemites are kind of envious of all the wealth of livestock that they have, and they want to get their hands on it somehow. We can't really have that kind of relationship with you and your friends unless you and all of the other young men of Shechem are circumcised. And the boy of Shechem is so keen to have Dinah that he says, okay, and he talks his friends all into being circumcised. And then what happens? When they're lying around after this, Reuben, Levi come and kill them all. Revenge for their sister. What she thinks of all this is, we don't know. Maybe she liked the guy. But she doesn't have any choice in the matter. And Jacob doesn't really do anything except, no, you boys. You guys are making me unpopular around here. That's about all he says. And by taking no real action in this case, he loses control of his boys. And from that time on, Jacob is just kind of tossed around. The boys really are the ones that make things happen, and Jacob is uh, almost powerless. Well, we're going to see the same thing now happening with David. David, the powerful king who subdues all the enemies round about. First, he fights for the kingdom when Saul is ruling, and he's very respectful to King Saul, even though Saul goes crazy and wants to kill David as his chief rival. David, just when he has the opportunity, who am I to touch, to lay a hand on the king's anointed? I can't do that. And he waits until the Philistines kill Saul and David's friend Jonathan, who is Saul's son. Then he's invited by the elders to come and rule, which he does. And things go very well for David. He's generous to Saul's descendants, particularly to his grandson, son of Jonathan, David's friend, a man named Mephibosheth, who was crippled at both feet because when Saul is killed, his nurse is running to escape the Philistines and drops the boy and breaks his legs, apparently. So he's crippled ever afterwards and not a very imposing person as a result. But David is kind and takes him into his house, feeds him at his table, and restores the land of Saul to this Mephibosheth. There are stories about the Ammonites who are singularly foolish in their behavior. David comes to sympathize when their king dies. He sends a sympathy delegation to, you know, show his respect, you know, and so forth. And the foolish young men of the kingdom say, these guys are spies. They're just coming to look around. And so they humiliate them and send them back to David with their robes cut off above their waists and cut off their beards and send them home. And of course, that makes David furious, and he decides to defeat the Ammonites, which he hadn't planned to do before. And he's very kind to the humiliated men. He feels sorry for them. He said, just keep quiet and let your beards grow back and get yourself a new robe. And he treats them well. Now, things are going pretty good until the time comes when kings go out to war in the spring. And we'll start, I want to talk about David's house first. David, as he is being established in the kingdom, decides he's got a nice house, and he decides that it doesn't seem right that he should have a nice house, and God is still dwelling in the tabernacle, in this tent. So he wants to build a house for God. 2 Samuel 7, we'll look at some of that. Now, when the king was settled in his house, this is after he conquers Jerusalem and builds himself a house there and brings the Ark of God into Jerusalem, establishes it as his capital. And dances before the Ark of the Lord, and Saul's daughter Michal doesn't like it. It's not dignified for the king. And he says, well, never mind. If you don't like it, the other girls think it looks pretty good. So, and she has no more children after that. Now, chapter 7. When the king was settled in his house, and the Lord had given him rest from all his enemies around him, the king said to the prophet Nathan, see, I am living in a house of cedar, but the ark of God stays in a tent. Remember the ark from the time of the wilderness wandering? It was staying in another place, and now it's been brought to Jerusalem. Nathan said to the king, go do all that you have in mind, for the Lord is with you. That's just his off-the-top-of-the-head reaction. But, verse 4, that same night, the word of the Lord came to Nathan, go and tell my servant David, thus says the Lord, are you the one to build me a house to live in? I have not lived in a house since the day I brought up the people of Israel from Egypt to this day, but I have been moving about in a tent and a tabernacle. Whenever I moved about among all the people of Israel, did I ever speak a word? with any of the tribal leaders of Israel, whom I commanded to shepherd my people Israel, saying, why have you not built me a house of cedar? Now therefore, thus you shall say to my servant David, thus says the Lord of hosts, I took you from the pasture, from following the sheep to be prince over my people Israel. And I have been with you wherever you went, and have cut off all your enemies from before you. And I will make for you a great name, like the name of the great ones of the earth. And I will appoint a place for my people Israel, and will plant them so that they may live in their own place and be disturbed no more. And evildoers shall afflict them no more as formerly. From the time that I appointed judges over my people Israel, and I will give you rest from all your enemies. Moreover, and this is the key, I think, the Lord declares to you that the Lord will make you a house. And then he goes on to talk about verse 16. Your house and your kingdom shall be made sure forever before me. Your throne shall be established forever. In accordance with all these words and with all this vision, Nathan spoke to David. So David wants to build God a house, and what does God say?
No.
I'm going to build you a house. And what does he mean by that?
Isn't that a reiteration of the promise to Abraham?
It's a new form of the ancient promise. The promise of being a great nation, numerous people, having a land, and having and blessing all peoples through that clan, that family, that nation. And now that we have a king, that promise is attached also to the house of the king. Originally, you know, God said when they wanted a king, Samuel tried to dissuade them from it, and God was not too keen about having a king. But once it was established, then God put his blessing on this house of David. And of course, when Jesus appeared and began preaching, teaching, healing, he was from time to time addressed as what? Son of David. Bartimaeus, the blind beggar, cries out, Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. Now, David wasn't a healer, but he sees something in David, in Jesus, that attaches in his mind that power that God has promised to that family. And if you look at the genealogies in Matthew and Luke, it comes right down through King David, and then on down to Jesus. This eternal kingship, in spite of all the things we're going to read about today, that promise still prevails. Let's look now, having seen David established and this wonderful promise, I will build you a house and your a descendant shall rule forever on the throne. Then we come to chapter 11. And in between 7 and 11, David has a lot of military successes with the help of Joab, his chief general. And this year, when Joab goes out to fight the Ammonites, David doesn't go. He stays home, and I think he's bored. Verse chapter 11. In the spring of the year, the time when kings go out to battle, David sent Joab with his officers and all Israel with him. They ravaged the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah, that's the capital of Ammon. But David remained at Jerusalem. It happened late one afternoon when David rose from his couch, walking about on the roof of the king's house. Just, you know, it sounds sort of bored. What shall I do? He'd rather be fighting. Then he saw from the roof a woman bathing. The woman was very beautiful. David sent someone to inquire about the woman. It was reported, this is Bathsheba, daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite. Remember the Hittites? These are the some of the people of the land, Canaanite. At least they've been living in Canaan, whether they're originally Canaanites or not. So he's not an Israelite by birth anyway. So David sent messengers to get her. And she came to him, and he lay with her. Now she was purifying herself after her period. That's why she was taking a bath. People didn't bathe all that much in those days. Then she returned to her house. The woman conceived, and she sent and told David, "I am pregnant." Bathsheba has only one line in this whole story, but it's a good one. So, what's David going to do now? This could be embarrassing. He sent word to Joab, "Send to me Uriah the Hittite." And Joab sent Uriah to David. When Uriah came to him, David asked how Joab and the people fared and how the war was going. Then David said to Uriah, "Go down to your house and wash your feet." This is a euphemism. Uriah went out of the king's house, and there followed him a present from the king. The king is being really nice to Uriah. Takes him out of the battle, sends him, tell him to go home, have some fun with your wife. You know. But Uriah slept at the entrance of the king's house with all the servants of his lord and did not go down to his house. When they told David Uriah did not go down to his house, David said to Uriah, "You've just come from a journey. Why did you not go down to your house?" Uriah said to David, "The ark and Israel and Judah remain in booths." Apparently they're taking the ark out to war with them as they used to do in ancient times before that. "And my lord Joab and the servants of my lord are camping in the open field. Shall I then go to my house to eat and to drink and to lie with my wife?" He says it right out. He didn't know he was here. "As you live and as your soul lives, I will not do such a thing." Why won't he go down? His buddies are out and, you know, out fighting wars, and they're out in the open field campaigning. So he is in his mind with them, and he's not going to take his ease while they're out there struggling. Then David said to Uriah, "Remain here today also. Tomorrow I'll send you back." So Uriah remained in Jerusalem that day. On the next day, David invited him to eat and drink in his presence and made him drunk. And in the evening, he went out to lie on his couch with the servants of his lord, but he did not go down to his house. He stayed around David's house. So what's David going to do now? In the morning, David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it by the hand of Uriah. What is Uriah carrying with him back to Joab? In the letter he wrote, "Set Uriah in the forefront of the hardest fighting and then draw back from him so that he may be struck down and die." As Joab was besieging the city, he assigned Uriah to the place where he knew there were valiant warriors, that is, among the Ammonites. The men of the city came out and fought with Joab, and some of the servants of David among the people fell. Uriah the Hittite was killed as well. Then Joab sent and told David all the news about the fighting, and he instructed the messenger, "When you have finished telling the king all the news about the fighting, and the king's anger rises, and he says to you, 'Why did you go so near the city to fight? Did you not know that they would shoot from the wall? Who killed Abimelech, son of Jerubbaal? Did not a woman throw an upper millstone on him from the wall so that he died in Thebes? Why did you go so near the wall?' Then you shall say, 'Your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead too.'" So the messenger went and came and told David all that Joab had sent him to tell. The men said to David, "The men gained an advantage over us and came out against us in the field, but we drove them back to the entrance of the gate. Then the archers shot at your servants from the wall. Some of the king's servants are dead, and your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead also." David said to the messengers, "Thus you shall say to Joab, 'Do not let this matter trouble you, for the sword devours now one and now another. Press your attack on the city and overthrow it and encourage him.'" When the wife of Uriah heard that her husband was dead, she made lamentation for him. When the mourning was over, David sent and brought her to his house, and she became his wife and bore him a son. Well, what happened? The Lord's anointed becomes an agent of death of honorable people. You see how honorable Uriah is. He won't do anything other than what a soldier would do. He still considers himself a man in arms, and he's not going to go anywhere near his wife, not going to enjoy any comforts. He just lies on the floor in the first night, and then when he gets drunk, at least he'll lie in a bed, but he won't go down to his house, even drunk. Well, David thinks maybe he's dodged the bullet here, but there's a bullet yet to come from the prophet Nathan. And he comes and tells David his story. You know the story. He tells the story of a rich man who has a visitor come to him. This is in chapter 12, if you want to kind of look at the way it is, I'll summarize it. A rich man had a visitor come and he wanted to feed him, and nearby there was a poor man who had one little lamb that he had raised almost like a child. He carried it in his bosom, he fed it from a cup, and it was a pet, almost like a child. And the rich man comes and takes that little lamb for his own meal to feed his guest. And David is furious. He tells Nathan, "Whoa, the man who does such a thing should die." And what does Nathan say?
"You're the man." Yeah.
"You are the man." And David's immediate reaction shows this is the greatness of David. "I have sinned against the Lord." Just like that. He recognizes who it is and he acknowledges what he's done. And Nathan tells him, "The Lord has forgiven your sin. However, so you won't die. However, you have brought the sword into Uriah's house, and so the sword will enter your house and will not leave it until the day you die." And this, bringing this death into the house of Uriah, has now opened the door to his own house for the sword to enter it, which it does. And one thing after another goes bad, and we have a soap opera that would outdo any of the soap operas you can see on television. The subsequent story of David's family, with rape and murder and assassination and deceit and rebellion and scorn for David, and yet he survives through all of this and dies really still on the throne.
Jonathan, yeah. It's interesting when you look at that piece. David, I'll repay fourfold. Then
when David says, "The man who has done this thing deserves to die, he shall restore the lamb fourfold," verse 6, right. Because he did this thing, because he had no pity. Right. Yeah.
And what's interesting is it ends up that four of David's sons die subsequent to this. Mm.
You know, that's a good point. Yeah, we got Amnon, Absalom, see who else.
The baby that's born
is the first one, right?
And then
there's one more. Yeah, you're probably right.
Is that a Levitical? You see that again in the New Testament with the
Zacchaeus.
Yeah. Same thing. All repaid for. Was that a Levitical?
I'm not sure where that comes from.
Piece that for repaying ill-gotten gain.
There is in Exodus 22:1 a reference. Now let's see if that has to do with that. It's to that verse. It's just a cross-reference. I don't know if it's relevant, but that's legal stuff. Yes. When someone steals an ox or a sheep and slaughters it or sells it, the thief shall pay 5 oxen for an ox and 4 sheep for a sheep. Okay. There it is. Thank you. Exodus 22:1. Yep, there it is.
I have a question.
Yeah.
David does all this because he doesn't want to have it come out that he has slept with Bathsheba. But kings of that time could pretty much do whatever they wanted. How awful would it have been for him to have acknowledged or had this come out that he had, had this child with Bathsheba? Was he avoiding a small problem and creating a huge problem?
Politicians do that all the time.
Remember Richard Nixon?
If he said at the beginning, those guys, they overstepped, but they were doing things that I was telling to. They just went too far. But I take responsibility for it. If he'd done that from the beginning, I think he would have lived out his term. But he'd cover up, and it just got bigger and bigger and bigger, and the news people wouldn't let it go.
Bill Clinton.
And Bill Clinton, same thing. If he had said, I don't know, he would have got ragged pretty hard if he had admitted it, but probably not as bad as the cover-up made it.
What's the funny news?
Yeah. Yeah, Clinton wasn't, no, it wasn't a, this was not a married woman, and it was didn't involve a murder of a husband, so it wasn't quite as big a thing as, although certainly abuse of power, that's for sure, and not very nice for his wife and daughter. Go ahead.
Is the king in Israel supposed to be the moral example or model?
Well, thus far David really has been. His behavior has been, quite honorable. He has been generous to his defeated enemies, and he has been, when he wants to buy, that comes later on, when he buys the threshing floor. But he is, he's a good-hearted guy on the whole. So this isn't so much like David, but from this time on, things get worse, fall apart, and he loses, yeah.
The real sin here from the story of Nathan is not a sexual morality thing, and it's not. I think he probably could have taken another man's wife without it being too big a deal, but it is the deceit, the murder, him acting as a tyrant, the oppression of the poor.
And Nathan makes a big thing. Remember when God responds to David's idea of building God a house? He reviews all the things that he's done for David. I took you from the sheepfold. You were a shepherd boy. And I've made you ruler of this, my people. And when Nathan speaks to him, he says, you have wives, all the wives you want, and all of Saul's wives are yours if you want them, and any other, as many as you want you could have, why you have to take this one? So that suggests David could have as many wives as he wants, but not to steal some other righteous person's wife and then kill the guy.
Is there a piece here of marrying outside the clan?
Because
she was Hittite.
Yeah. Well, it could be that David doesn't feel as responsible for Uriah as Uriah does for David, because he's a Hittite. But Uriah talks about the Ark of God. He's very respectfully, like he's considered himself part of the community. Apparently, he's fighting for this nation.
Part of what the story points out too is that when there's a crime committed, oftentimes you can be forgiven spiritually, theologically. There's also a civil penalty to pay.
And that's exactly what Nathan says.
Yeah.
There are consequences. God will forgive you, but you have brought, you've set in motion a train of events that is going to devastate your family. And here it starts in chapter 13. After Joab gets victory over the Ammonites finally, and they knock down their cities and so forth. Some time passed, chapter 13. David's son Absalom had a beautiful sister whose name was Tamar. And David's son Amnon fell in love with her. These are half-brothers, Amnon and Absalom. Amnon was so tormented that he made himself ill because of his sister Tamar, for she was a virgin, and it seemed impossible to Amnon to do anything to her. But Amnon had a friend whose name was Jonadab, the son of David's brother Shimeah, would be his cousin. And Jonadab was a very crafty man. He said to him, "O son of the king, why are you so haggard morning after morning? Will you not tell me?" I'm trying to be helpful. Amnon said to him, "I love Tamar, my brother Absalom's sister." Jonadab said to him, "Lie down in your bed, pretend to be ill. When your father comes to see you, say to him, 'Let my sister Tamar come and give me something to eat, and prepare the food in my sight so that I may see it and eat it from her hand.'" So Amnon lay down and pretended to be ill, and when the king came to see him, Amnon said to the king, "Please let my sister Tamar come and make a couple of cakes in my sight so that I may eat from her hand before I die." Then David sent home to Tamar saying, "Go to your brother Amnon's house and prepare food for him." So Tamar went to her brother Amnon's house where he was lying down. She took dough, kneaded it, made cakes in his sight, and baked the cakes. Then she took the pan and set them out before him, but he refused to eat. Amnon said, "Send everyone out from me." So everyone went out from him. Then Amnon said to Tamar, "Bring the food into the chamber so that I might eat from your hand." So Tamar took the cakes she had made, brought them into the chamber to Amnon, her brother. But when she brought them near him to eat, he took hold of her and said to her, "Come, lie with me, my sister." She answered, "No, my brother, do not force me, for such a thing is not done in Israel. Do not do anything so vile. As for me, where could I carry my shame? And as for you, you would be as one of the scoundrels in Israel. Now, therefore, I beg you, speak to the king, for he will not withhold me from you." But he would not listen to her, and being stronger than she, he forced her and lay with her. Then Amnon was seized with a very great loathing for her. Indeed, his loathing was even greater than the lust he had felt for her. Amnon said to her, "Get off!" But she said to him, "No, my brother, for this wrong in sending me away is greater than the other that you did to me." But he would not listen to her. He called the young man who served him and said, "Put this woman out of my presence," and bolt the door after her. Now she was wearing a long robe with sleeves, for this is how the virgin daughters of the king were clothed in earlier times. So his servant put her out and bolted the door after her. But Tamar put ashes on her head and tore the long robe that she was wearing. She put her hand on her head and went away crying aloud as she went. Her brother Absalom said to her, "Has Amnon your brother been with you? Be quiet for now, my sister. He's your brother. Do not take this to heart." So Tamar remained a desolate woman in her brother Absalom's house. When King David heard of all these things, he became very angry, but he would not punish his son Amnon, because he loved him, for he was his firstborn. But Absalom spoke to Amnon neither good nor bad, for Absalom hated Amnon because he had raped his sister Tamar. Well, the troubles are beginning. Phyllis Tribble has written a story, a book called Texts of Terror. And this is one of those texts of terror. Many of them have to do with the treatment of women in these Bible stories. Did Amnon love Tamar? What are the words that are used in his behavior toward her? Grasping, seizing, forcing. Is that love?
Not at all.
He's lusting after his half-sister, a girl that he should treat as a sister. He traps her by deception, deceiving also his father, taking advice from a rascal, Jonadab, and ignoring Tamar's no and all of her wise counsel, and then to cap it off, rejecting her in a very harsh way. after he's raped her. And David was angry, but what could he do? Who had sent Tamar into Amnon? David himself had told her to go there. He tied his hands, and not only that, Amnon knew what his father had done with Bathsheba. He was just doing what he'd seen Daddy do, only with a meaner twist to it. At least David did love Bathsheba, as Shechem had loved Dinah, for that matter, and treated her well. And in fact, she became quite strong at the end of David's reign, particularly. Tamar was not as pliant as Bathsheba had been. She doesn't just go. She objected strenuously and very, eloquently. She proved to be a very intelligent and sensible person, but just she wasn't cautious enough, if in fact she had any choice in the matter. She said, "Don't force me. This is not done in Israel. This is wicked. And I will be disgraced, and you will be disgraced as well." But, and finally she says, "If you really want me, ask the king. He'll give me to you." He has already handed her over to him, although that wasn't his intention. Notice the brother-sister language. What does the word mean to the two of them? To Tamar, brother means you should be protecting me, taking care of me. And to Amnon, sister means you should give me what I want. He should also keep in mind, she says, all the other relationships that he's trashing with his father and with his half-brother, half-brothers, particularly Absalom. But Tamar's sensible appeal is to no avail, because Amnon is not being ruled by reason here, is he? His glands are ruling his lust and his really twisted heart. And then, once he's possessed her, his lust turns to revulsion, as happens with nasty, self-centered people. His behavior is that of an abuser, isn't it? The ugliness which he himself had committed, what does he do? He projects it on Tamar. "No, you slut, get out of here." That's kind of the attitude. The abuser who works himself up into loathing to justify his beating of this innocent woman who has fallen into his clutches. And it's stuff that comes out of their own twisted heart. Tamar tells him exactly. Now, she still has a presence of mind, even after he's raped her, to quote scripture to him. "Having raped a virgin who has not been pledged to anyone in marriage, he must marry her, and he can never divorce her." This is Exodus 22, 16, 17. Deuteronomy 22, 28, 29. That's the law. And so she appeals to the law. But he pays no attention to that either. I don't think Amnon expected her to make it public. He thought that she'd be embarrassed, and she'd hush it up, and he'd get away with it. But what does she do? She makes a spectacle of herself. She seizes the brief opportunity that she has before Absalom gets a hold of her and calms her down, tells her to be quiet. She puts ashes on her head, tears her robe, and goes around wailing and crying so everybody knows what has happened. She makes the appeal for justice as she can do it. Well, who's the one that can act on her behalf? Since King David doesn't, who's left but her full brother, Absalom? Does he confront Amnon? Does he complain to David? What does he do? He says, "Just keep quiet. It's no big deal. These things happen." Maybe he thought it shouldn't be any big deal to her, but it was to him. And he provided shelter to Tamar, all right, but he doesn't seem to be that interested in how she's feeling. Maybe he's driven by the assault on his own pride that someone could do this to his sister. And maybe a glimmer of opportunism here. He could also be thinking of future political ambitions. The oldest son would be the first one looked to as the future successor to David, right? Mm-hmm. Who is that? That's Amnon. I've got a handle on Amnon. It could be. There's nothing in the text about that, but when you see the way the scrambling for the throne at the time of David's approaching death, you have to keep these dynastic questions in mind. We know he's planning revenge, yes.
Yeah, isn't he maybe keeping her quiet, keeping everything quiet, so that Amnon won't suspect that he is going to take revenge?
Yes, that's...
Because it's 2 years before he does.
He keeps quiet for 2 years. He mm-hmm. says neither good nor bad to Absalom during this time. He's laying his plans. Finally, when the things sort of settle down, people aren't thinking about that much, he puts on a big party for the sons of the king. And he invites David to come. I'm having a sheep shearing party. And remember the sheep shearing party that Laban was engaged in when Jacob makes his escape with Leah and Rachel? This that kind of thing again. And it's a little bit like the harvesting festivities that Boaz is engaged in when Ruth comes and crawls under his blanket at Naomi's suggestion. Ruth, who is the grandmother of David, in fact. We can read a little of that one too. After two full years, 1323, Absalom had sheep shears at Baal Hazor, which is near Ephraim, and Absalom invited all the king's sons. Absalom came to the king and said, "Your servant has sheep shears. Will the king and his servants please go with your servant?" But the king said to Absalom, "No, my son, let us not all go, or else we will be burdensome to you." He pressed him, but he would not go, but gave him his blessing. Then Absalom said, "If not, please let my brother Amnon go with us." The king said, "Well, why should he go with you?" But Absalom pressed him until he let Amnon and all the king's sons go with him. Absalom is pressing now, just like Amnon was pressing 2 years ago. Absalom made a feast like a king's feast. There's something a little bit prophetic here, because Absalom is going to declare himself king not too far in the future. Then Absalom commanded his servants, "Watch when Amnon's heart is merry with wine. And when I say to you, strike Amnon, then kill him." Remember how David got Uriah drunk to try to escape the consequence of what he had done?
Kind of a family tradition.
Yeah. "Do not be afraid. Have I not myself commanded you?" In other words, he's taking responsibility for what they're going to do. "Be courageous and valiant." So this is a very courageous thing to do, kill a drunk man. So the servants of Absalom did to Amnon as Absalom had commanded. Then all the king's sons rose and each mounted his mule and fled. Probably thought they were going to kill them all. And that's the report that came to David. 30. While they were on the way, the report came to David that Absalom had killed all the king's sons, and not one of them was left. The king rose, tore his garments, and lay on the ground, and all his servants who were standing by tore their garments. But Jonadab, the son of David's brother Shimeah, said, "Let not my lord suppose that they have killed all the young men, the king's sons. Amnon alone is dead. This has been determined by Absalom from the day Amnon raped his sister Tamar. Now, therefore, do not let my lord the king take it to heart, as if all the king's sons were dead, for Amnon alone is dead." This is like Absalom talking to Tamar. "Oh, he's just been raped. That's no big deal." So David gets a lot of helpful advice from Jonadab again. Remember Jonadab? He is the guy that set the thing up in the first place that gave Amnon the idea of how to get Tamar. And now he's being helpful again to David. But Absalom fled, verse 34. When the young man who kept watch looked up, he saw many people coming from the Horonaim road by the side of the mountain. Jonadab said to the king, "See, the king's sons have come. As your servant said, so it has come about." See, I was right. As soon as he had finished speaking, the king's sons arrived and raised their voices and wept, and the king and all his servants also wept very bitterly. Both for Amnon and both for their own terror, they thought they were going to die, I think. But Absalom fled and went to Talmai, son of Ammihud, king of Geshur, people we don't know much about otherwise. David mourned for his son day after day. That's Amnon. Absalom, having fled to Geshur, stayed there 3 years, and the heart of the king went out yearning for Absalom, for he was now consoled over the death of Amnon. He started to miss Absalom. Well,
why would
the sword has entered David's house for sure, big time now.
These sons and all must have been beyond the age of consent. Why would they need the king's permission to go to a party?
Well, I think there's a little symmetry to this. Mm-hmm. Who was it that sent Tamar to go feed Amnon?
Okay.
That was David. And who sends Amnon to go and join the feed with Absalom? Okay. It's David again. He himself is the unwitting agent of both of these things, at least part of the agency by which they happened. So David himself, his own hands, you know, not only in the past, but it goes on. He himself is involved in these things. He had missed the chance to break that cycle of violence when he didn't do anything about Amnon's treatment of Tamar, and now it goes on. Well, actually, it goes back to the Bathsheba thing. Yeah, you could take this story word for word and run it on all my children. You could say, wow.
That's a do that every day.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And David finally finds himself longing for Absalom. It's kind of foolish, but maybe it's a little like, he was a shepherd, remember? Remember Jesus' story about the shepherd who has 100 sheep? And there's the one that's missing that he's thinking about? And maybe David has something of that in him too, the one the shepherd concentrates on. Well, Joab has seen how the king was caught with a story by Nathan. And he cooks one up too, using a wise woman as a storyteller. That's maybe we won't go into that whole story. This is in chapter 14. But David has kind of lost power to shape events. Just like Jacob later in his life is kind of jerked around by his sons, same thing happens here to David. Things happen to him, with a few exceptions. On his deathbed, David seems to be a bit doddering, and he's too cold, he can't get warm, and they get this beautiful young virgin Abishag to lie with him and keep him warm. That's all. There's nothing more to it, but she's keeping him warm. And doesn't seem he's got much to say anymore. But when Bathsheba comes into him to say, Absalom has... No, this isn't Absalom. This is... The other son. Also starts with A. Ha! How could I forget that one? Anyway, another son declares himself king. And David arises and starts acting like a king. He summons his last strength to give instructions. Tell Nathan to get Solomon, put him on my donkey, and get the chief priests and all the priests and everybody else to come and hail him as king and put him on the throne, because Solomon is to be on my throne. And it's Bathsheba who's made this appeal to David. Didn't you promise that Solomon would be the king?
It's Adonijah.
Adonijah, thank you very much, yes. And then he says, now Adonijah has declared himself king. What is to happen to Solomon? Bathsheba realizes that she and Solomon are probably dead ducks if Adonijah is able to establish himself as king.
Is there a little reflection of Rebecca here with Jacob?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. very much like Rebecca really takes charge. She doesn't really deceive David, because in fact, it's probably what David wants to do anyway. Bathsheba has become his favorite wife. And just like Rachel was Jacob's favorite wife, and so it's natural for him to want Solomon. But whether he has actually promised that Solomon, maybe he doesn't remember if he promised it, but if Bathsheba says so, it must be true. And he acts as though that's his intention, that Solomon should be king. Whether it was or not, we don't know. Well, Absalom is in exile. And Joab apparently senses that David really is longing for him. Why Joab wants Absalom to come back, I don't know. Maybe he thinks David's mind is distracted too much from affairs of state by the absence of Absalom. He would calm down and focus on his work if Absalom came back. And maybe he misjudges Absalom a bit too. So he does a little trick to get... Well, let's read the story. Chapter 14, The Woman of Tekoa. Now Joab, son of Zeruiah, perceived that the king's mind was on Absalom. Joab sent to Tekoa, brought from there a wise woman. He said to her, "Pretend to be a mourner. Put on mourning garments. Do not anoint yourself with oil, but behave like a woman who has been mourning many days for the dead. Go to the king and speak to him as follows." And Joab put the words into her mouth. When the woman of Tekoa came to the king, she fell on her face to the ground and did obeisance, and said, "Help, O king!" The king asked her, "What is your trouble?" She answered, "Alas, I am a widow. My husband is dead. Your servant had two sons, and they fought with one another in the field. There was no one to part them. One struck the other and killed him. Now the whole family has risen against your servant. They say, 'Give up the man who struck his brother, so that we may kill him for the life of his brother whom he murdered, even if we destroy the heir as well.' Thus they would quench my one remaining ember and leave to my husband neither name nor remnant on the face of the earth." Then the king said to the woman, "Go to your house, and I will give orders concerning you." The woman of Tekoa said to the king, "On me be the guilt, my lord the king, and on my father's house. Let the king and his throne be guiltless." The king said, "If anyone says anything to you, bring him to me, and he shall never touch you again." Then she said, "Please, may the king keep the Lord your God in mind, so that the avenger of blood may kill no more, and my son not be destroyed." He said, "As the Lord lives, not one hair of your son shall fall to the ground." Then the woman said, "Please let your servant speak a word to my lord the king." He said, "Speak." The woman said, "Why then have you planned such a thing against the people of God? For in giving this decision, the king convicts himself, inasmuch as the king does not bring his banished one home again. We must all die. We are like water spilled on the ground, which cannot be gathered up. But God will not take away a life. He will devise plans so as not to keep an outcast banished forever from his presence. Now I have come to say this to my lord the king, because the people have made me afraid. Your servant thought, 'I will speak to the king, it may be that the king will perform the request of his servant. For the king will hear and deliver his servant from the hand of the man who would cut both me and my son off from the heritage of God.' Your servant thought, 'The word of my lord the king will set me at rest, for my lord the king is like the angel of God, discerning good and evil. Lord your God be with you.' Then the king answered the woman, 'Do not withhold from me anything I ask you.' The woman said, 'Let my lord the king speak.' The king said, 'Is the hand of Joab with you in all this?'" I smell a rat. "The woman answered and said, 'As surely as you live, my lord the king, one cannot turn right or left from anything that my lord the king has said. Where was your servant Joab who commanded me? It was he who put all these words into the mouth of your servant. In order to change the course of affairs, your servant Joab did this. But my lord has wisdom like the wisdom of the angel of God to know all the things that are on the earth.'" Then the king said to Joab, he doesn't tell the woman, says to Joab, "Very well, I grant this. Go bring back the young man Absalom." Joab prostrated himself with his face to the ground and did obeisance and blessed the king. And Joab said, "Today your servant knows that I have found favor in your sight, my lord the king, in that the king has granted the request of his servant. So Joab set off, went to Geshur, and brought Absalom to Jerusalem. The king said, "Let him go to his own house. He is not to come into my presence." So Absalom went to his own house and did not come into the king's presence. So did he run out to meet him, put a robe on a ring on his finger, kill the fatted calf? No. He's here, but he's here on sufferance. And for 2 years, in verse 28, he lives in Jerusalem without coming into the king's presence. Absalom sent for Joab. Well, Absalom was a very handsome man. He had thick curls, and his hair was very heavy when he cut it off. He had sons and Tamar. Tamar appears again. So he lived 2 years in Jerusalem without coming to the king's presence. He sent for Joab to send him to the king, but Joab would not come to him. It was Joab that came to get him from Geshur. So he deals through Joab. He's not allowed to approach the king. He sent a second time, but Joab would not come. Then he said to his servants, "Look, Joab's field is next to mine, and he has barley there. Go and set it on fire." So Absalom's servants set the field on fire. Then Joab rose and went to Absalom at his house and said to him, "Why have your servants set my field on fire?" Absalom answered Joab, "Look, I sent word to you, come here that I may send you to the king with a question. Why have I come from Geshur? It would be better for me to be there still. Now, let me go into the king's presence. If there is guilt in me, let him kill me." Then Joab went to the king and told him, and he summoned Absalom. So he came to the king and prostrated himself with his face to the ground before the king, and the king kissed Absalom. So he finds a good way to get Joab's attention. Sets fire to his field. Who is it that kisses Absalom? Is it David the father?
David the king.
It's David the king. This is a political kiss, not a fatherly kiss. Absalom is really not fully forgiven and accepted. Who proves to be wiser between David and Joab in this case? What does Absalom do next? He starts currying favor with the people, building himself up in the eyes of the people.
Is he the next oldest son?
I don't know exactly the order.
Yeah.
It could be. He certainly sees himself as the heir apparent. And it's clear that Solomon comes some way down the line in the order. You know, David had a number of wives. He had wives here and there during his times of wandering around. And he has the Michal, the daughter of Saul, is one of his wives too. But that one has long since cooled off since he's come into Jerusalem. And she shows her scorn for him. After this, chapter 15, Absalom got himself a chariot and horses and 50 men to run ahead of him. He used to rise early and stand beside the road into the gate. When anyone brought a suit before the king for judgment, Absalom would call and say, "From what city are you?" When the person would say, "Your servant is of such and such a tribe in Israel," Absalom would say, "See, your claims are good and right, but there's no one deputed by the king to hear you." Absalom said, moreover, "If only I were judge in the land, then all who had a suit or cause would come to me, and I would give them justice." Whenever people came near to do obeisance to him, he would put out his hand and take hold of them and kiss them. Thus Absalom did to every Israelite who came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole the hearts of the king, hearts of the people of Israel. And then after 4 years, he makes an arrangement with the king. He says, I want to go to Hebron and pay the vow I have made to the Lord that if I got back from Geshur safely, I would worship the Lord at Hebron. The king said, go in peace. But what is he planning in Hebron? He sends secret messengers throughout all the tribes saying, as soon as you hear the sound of the trumpet, then shout, Absalom has become king at Hebron. 200 men from Jerusalem went with Absalom. They were invited guests, and they went in their innocence, knowing nothing of the matter. While Absalom was offering the sacrifices, he does offer sacrifice in Hebron, he sent for Ahithophel the Gilonite, David's counselor from his city Gilo. The conspiracy grew in strength, and the people with Absalom kept increasing. And a messenger comes to David saying, Absalom has won the hearts of the Israelites. And David says, let's go, let's flee, or we won't escape. And David runs from Jerusalem. And the whole next chapter 15, 16, David is running from Jerusalem. At the end of 16, Absalom comes into Jerusalem and takes over. There's not even any battle. He just takes over. Now, eventually, the thing turns around with Joab particularly. And Joab, who has brought Absalom back, what does he do? Yeah, it's time. Joab is the one who, when he finds Absalom hanging by his hair from a tree, this beautiful long hair of his, he's run under the tree and his hair caught in it, and the mule runs out from under him and Absalom is hanging there. Joab comes and stabs him in the heart. Joab, who brought him back from Geshur and finagled with David to make it happen. Well, what do you think of these stories? This promise, I will build you a house. What kind of a house has David got here anyway? I think this is a prophetic word that doesn't refer just to David and his family. But it does refer to one who is to come, who is to rule eternally. The son of David, that through all this tawdry business that takes place with David's family, all the chicanery and there's beautiful things that are done as well, and honor and shame, and it's all tangled together in that family, and glory and humiliation, and David experienced a great deal of both, driven from the city, and Absalom having sex with David's wives on the roof of the palace in the full sight of everybody to show that he's the king, showing himself to be just about as foolish as the brother, half-brother Amnon that he's killed. But Absalom gets his comeuppance in the end too. And David dies still the king, except that he himself hands over to Solomon just before he dies. Well, we'll close there with this story. Do you have any strong feelings between Jonah, Job, and Ecclesiastes?
Jonah.
I hear a vote for Jonah. We voted yesterday, we got 6, 6, and 6, more or less. That wasn't much help. I'm sort of inclined to Jonah or Job. Okay, I'll choose. He'll be surprised tomorrow. I've been looking at both of them, so I can't decide which one to do. Okay.
Let the Spirit lead you.
Yeah. Go in peace, serve the Lord.
Thank you.